I'm just going to read this. I was there in Birmingham for 5 days. We had 3 murders. Gangs fired 11 bullets at the police. Enough youths got bit by dogs. Elderly people had heart attacks. Mothers who kept their kids off school did not get paid for keeping them off. 3 weeks during the riots, I was supposed to be on a TV show with David Cameron, and they pulled us off. Where I'm coming from, and I'm just going to deliver this, I'm a criminologist, just about to finish my PhD. I'm one of the few people that actually talk to gang members, because the accusation was levelled at them. This is, for those who's into research, this is an ethnographic account. I was there. This is not secondhand directly, and you're going to hear some of the voices, because I think it's important that you understand the context in which I'm saying this. So I'm just going to read it, and I've been asked to cite some recommendations, because I'm one of those people at the moment advising Cameron, Miliband and Clegg. 15 years ago, you wouldn't have had me here. So understand one thing. 2 weeks ago, I was with Jackie Smith, the ex-Home Secretary, telling her that she failed as a Home Secretary to her face. So I'm just telling you, things have changed. And I want to thank Gus, Cecile, for coming and organising this. So I'm just going to get on with it. Firstly, I want to acknowledge the diligent work of all those who worked tirelessly behind the scenes during the disturbances to make my community a safer place to live. I would also like to thank those individuals, youth workers, community people, parents and faith leaders who also worked together and demonstrated a collective spirit to bring order to the chaos. I would also like to thank my son, age 15, who did not go out in the crowd, did keep his calm and demonstrated a level of maturity that made me as his father extremely proud. Contrary to popular belief, the vast majority of young black people did stay indoors, had supportive parents who ensured that they were safe from what was happening on the streets. The young people I'm referring to are not feral, a criminal class, nor mindless thugs. African-American sociologist and historian W.E.B. Du Bois criticised those sociologists who theorised from the inner city from a vantage point of comfort and detachment. Likewise, sociologist Jack Katz states, "I envy those who can somehow graciously transport themselves to intellectual worlds they have never inhabited before." Du Bois and Katz echo some of my own sentiments, namely that the insider perspective is important here to provide a balance to those who have been speculating from the outside. So this paper is a personal reflection on the disturbances that took place in England during August 2011. It's not written from the comfort zone of an office or part of a journalist's assignment, but from a position as a criminologist who experienced the disturbances up close and personal. As several weeks have now elapsed since the events took place, it's time to reflect, and as my good friend from Baltimore, Ted Sutton, would say, to pause for a minute. This paper will also challenge both the views of right-wing historian David Starkey, who on BBC Two's Newsnight programme used Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech to both attack and demean black culture, and David Cameron's ill-formed reaction when citing the riots were gang-related. This paper will present personal testimonies from members of Birmingham's black community whose voices will contest any notion of the disturbances being underpinned by race or black culture. The evidence to support my arguments is based on my travels to Nottingham, Manchester and Birmingham, where both the context and outcomes of the disturbances differed in orientation from region to region. It is more accurate to describe the diversity of those involved as an intersection of race, class, gender and age. But in saying that, there were certain aspects of the media coverage that I would define as being racialised. By racialised, I mean that there was a definite bias and an overemphasis on young black men. For the past 3 decades, I have talked to, engaged with and interviewed hundreds of young black people, some gang-related, some not, as well as younger and older black men in the criminal justice system, ranging from those on probation and those serving sentences in prison. In the main, they're disaffected, disillusioned, and disconnected from the social structure. Context. On the 4th of August 2011, Mark Duggan was shot by the police attempting to arrest him as part of a surveillance operation that went wrong. The IPC announced that Mark Duggan had not fired a shot as previously suggested. On the 6th of August, Mark Duggan's family and friends led a peaceful protest to Tottenham Police Station. This incident then became a tipping point for what would later become known as the English Riots. However, Prior to Mark Duggan's death, there were other police-related deaths that set the backdrop for the disturbances to come. On the 15th of March 2011, David Emmanuel, aka Smiley Culture, died from a stab wound to the heart following a police raid in his house. The police evidence suggested that Smiley inflicted a wound on himself. His death was also followed by a peaceful protest to Scotland Yard. On the 27th of March 2011, Kingsley Burrell, where I live in Birmingham, was arrested by the police, taken to a local mental health unit after an alleged struggle ensued. 3 days later, he was pronounced dead. Likewise, a peaceful protest took place. The cumulative impact of the three deaths created the conditions that led to a strong sense of outrage up and down the country within communities where these incidents occur frequently enough to warrant legitimate protest. These deaths were not confined to the location in which they took place, but were more symbolic of a long history of fatal encounters between young black men and the police. As the moral panic kicked in, the media largely ignored the recurring pattern of these events, going back many, many years, and underestimated the impact upon the psyche of the communities in which they took place. August 1958, Nottingham, Notting Hill, riot. August 1965, Watts, Los Angeles. August 1976, Notting Hill, and August 2011, Birmingham, London, Manchester. August is featured in riots because riots are seasonal. They don't take place in the winter unless it's prison. So one of the things I want to put in context is that these riots are predictable. As a criminologist, we predicted it. The night before we had the Hands of Carnival, we knew something was going down. So when the police chief of Birmingham said he didn't know it, he's lying. But if he'd admitted it, he would have lost his job. Mm-hmm. I have talked with many young black people, youth and community workers, faith leaders and parents about their views of what happened. Those issues have provided me with an insight to the underlying issues. The views expressed were wide and varied and reflected opinions that have not been sought by the media. Some of the interviews were recorded, others not. They were part of what I refer to as participant observation. The following interview is one such testimony from Jay, a young black male, age 19, from Handsworth, in inner city Birmingham. It's typical of many young black people I encountered. Jay represents a viewpoint that many of us find uncomfortable, as he comes across as brash, arrogant and frightening. However, his story has a context and needs to be heard. Jay talks about his connection to the streets, which we refer to as on road. Who am I? What have I got? Where am I going? Every time I look in the mirror, I see two shady eyes looking back at me. I say to myself, what's the purpose of my life? Is it making money, driving fancy cars, living the fast life, or is it being a family man, spending time with my kids at the weekend? I know people are judging us, but they've judged us before like they did our parents. Crap time at school, fighting all the time, teachers didn't give a damn, dad's absent, mum couldn't control me, so the streets called me out. Beef comes and goes, you do your thing on road, link the man's them from the ends, and we do what we gotta do. I ain't got nothing, and I don't feel anything about who says that, apart from my mum and my brethrens. Enough people feel that on road is easy. It ain't easy. Mans can be dead at any time. I've lost enough of my brethrens, so I've got to maintain myself. I can't let fool rule me. I know what I am and what I must do. So if I do get catched during the riots, then I'll do time. You know something, there must be something better out there, because the system is getting away with it. Liberties, you get me? Peace. Jay's testimony is not simply coming from a mindless thug, but someone who has been impacted by social strain and neglect. So I asked Jay if he's ever had anyone show him a different and better way. Jay pours scorn on all those so-called professionals and other vested interests who, in spite of being well-intentioned, misunderstood one basic thing. Namely, Jay's poor start in life should have been picked up and addressed way before it went wrong. I now meet C, a youth worker who is based in Handsworth, who was a significant safety blanket for many young black youths during the disturbances. C expresses a level of empathy towards those who were involved in the disturbances. As C says, my interest was never the disturbances, rather than what the root cause of why people feel that they should burn things down, attack the police, rob local stores and attack people at random. Although none of us condone this type of behaviour, the reality of it is that actions didn't stem from nowhere. I lost my uncle, my friend and another family friend due to murder in the hands of our so-called protectors, the police. So what we have seen or have seen on the streets is a symptom of injustice, racism and an us and them mentality between the haves and have-nots. My view stems from around the misuse of power, social exclusion, social injustice and the lack of resources that when the youth grow up, there's nothing for them to have. Until people start addressing the illness and not the symptoms, it's going to be difficult to move forward. Our conversation is cut short with the arrival of Birmingham gang member from the Burgers, known as T. T and C touch fists and I'm given a formal introduction, which is more like a vetting process. Gang members like T are cautious at all times, and introductions only happen on a need-to-know basis and if you've got credibility. If your face don't fit or you're not credible, you don't get access to guys like T. I explain what I'm doing to T, who agrees to give me a couple of minutes of his time. T says, "Yo, I ain't down with people burning down shops and looting, but burning police stations, getting the police makes sense because I've been beaten, my mum's arm's been broken, and I've experienced my friends going through the same things. So whenever I hear a black, white, Asian man get attacked or murdered, and I see the police get away with it, it hurts. So I respond the only way I know how to, which is to cause terror on the streets." T takes a call and moves away, and after a short while, bounds back, touches fists and exit. T reminds me of the legions of young men who I come into contact with, who see the road as a way in which they establish and negotiate the code of the streets. This in turn becomes a coping strategy that rules them out of accepting the drudgery of life on the margins. Many gang members I have worked with have good parents, are good people, their parents are good people, their parents work hard, their parents embrace a faith, and their parents have battled with providing their siblings with security, love and resources. What is seldom discussed is when advertisers and marketing companies create a motivation for greed that hard-working parents with little or no money can't compete with. So how do we then make sense of a young person from a privileged background engaging in criminality during the riots alongside disaffected youths like T? An explanation could lie in what we in criminology refer to as relative deprivation. Relative deprivation occurs when individuals or groups subjectively perceive themselves as unfairly disadvantaged over others, where they perceive as having similar attributes but having more rewards. Relative deprivation also involves understanding the disparity between culturally induced aspirations, such as individualism and consumerism, and the limited opportunities to realise them. T makes me think about the prisons I've worked in, the criminal justice system and the wider society. The rhetorical posturing of David Cameron, who attempted to apportion blame for the disturbances onto gangs, also comes into play. Cameron's position is not only flawed, but his argument is significantly weakened by the diversity of those who are involved in the riots in terms of age, race, class and gender. These riots transcended the issue of race and provided a context which was intersectional, which is what Cecile was talking about, and also Gus, in terms of race and class, by both design and default. By that, I mean there were issues of race, class, gender all at work. Now, in the early stages of the riots, we had numerous accounts citing young men as the problem. The focus then became young black men as the problem. But then we went to Manchester and we saw a swarm of young working class white men come into the fore. And then in the aftermath of the arrest, it emerges that women, both young and old, were involved, as well as a range of professionals. This inaccurate depiction would suggest that an examination of intersectionality is more appropriate to look at it to analyse the findings. In saying that, the race card was played more than once by the media, not the black community, as an attempt to racialise the moral panic that ensued. You see, where I live, the reality of the streets devours young lives for the sake of turf, revenge, retribution, robbery, mistaken identity, hatred, and numerous other reasons. And for those of you that's never experienced it, firsthand, the panic, shouting, screaming, smashing of glass, police sirens, helicopters, combined with pitch battles between police and looters, is not only frightening, but it can be traumatic for those caught in the crossfire. I head off to Newtown, where, for a few days earlier, the police released footage of a group of gang members on the streets during the disturbances who shot at a helicopter 11 times. I arrive at a small council house where I'm greeted by a group of black women, all mothers, who weren't there, whose children weren't out there. Something that had been evident throughout my travels is the upset of mothers who felt unduly labelled and targeted with playing a role in the decline of their children's morals and values. S, a young mother, agrees to talk to me. It was wrong. It was the government's fault. The youth have no education, no jobs, so they saw an opportunity and took it. I was disgusted at mothers being out there. I've got children and there's no way my 9-year-old would have been out there, even though my children might get something. It doesn't mean that they're going to get it, other than get it from me. How I see it, the government have stopped parents from disciplining their children, so they begin to stray. The government need to stop taking the power away from parents. S demonstrates the importance of good parental controls and having the power to enforce them. She also realises the limitations of parenting when the marketing of material goods enables some children to put additional strain on their parents. My interviews have also reminded me that the disturbances have also given rise to many positive and meaningful acts of support, kindness and organisation. Even if the wider society has largely ignored those positive gestures, those of us who live in the community know only full well that something good has and will continue to emerge out of these dreadful events. So, solutions. Because I've been talking to the politicians, gang members, community leaders, and one of the things that it seems to me, a lot of people are going to get money on the back of this riots. And I can tell you right now, the gang members I work with, you better hope they ain't in your prisons in Oxford, because they know who's getting the money. And if you ain't spending it for the benefit of community, trust me, we had 3 people dead in Birmingham. If that father never came out and spoke, you'd have had at least a dozen. And I was there. And one of the things that's got to stop is people think they can capitalise on people's pain. It's not worth it. So I'm going to provide some of you lot with solutions. Because if you ever come to Birmingham and you say, yo, I want to get involved, I'm going to hold you to this. Because I don't see why we should be standing up talking about this and people get away with writing a thesis or an article. When my son couldn't go out for 5 days because they burnt a car outside the house. 3 weeks ago, I witnessed a guy getting murdered outside my house. And that was painful. So what I'm saying here in the solutions, and why I'm saying I'm glad I've come to speak to you, because the tables have turned. Because the complexion of some of us who can take decisions go way beyond the neoliberal agenda. Understand that. And I'm not being funny, but until you've sat with a mother who's burying her son, unless you saw the 10,000 people who came out to the funeral of those 3 guys that got murdered, it's hard for you to appreciate, and I don't expect you to. But if you want Oxford to be safe, understand you're 5 years away from it. Because where do you think all the Birmingham gang members come when they find it hot? Here. Watford, Slough. So these are some of the solutions, because I don't want anybody thinking, because your beauty about now, I'm angry still, but I'm an academic. So I can argue that and get away with it, but I'm still angry. So I'm going to cite some solutions. First thing is, this time last year I was at Johns Hopkins University. Did you know that all of the surgeons that train in Iraq go to Baltimore streets to learn about gunshot trauma? I was there for 2 months at the Winston Churchill Fellowship. So the first solution is this, public health. In my view, that any future remedies should be located within a wider public health agenda, as a criminal justice solution will only serve to incarcerate the problem, not solve it. The public health framing should acknowledge the trauma and the need for a programme of recovery for all communities that have been badly affected. To move beyond father absence, hypermasculinity, fatalism, nihilism and poor self-concept that emerged out of the riots, there has to be a well-resourced and sustainable response that leads to community healing and restoration, which means this has to be taken as serious as heart attacks, diabetes and strokes. But criminal justice responses is the length of a government. And if you trust this government to solve your problems, you got another thing coming. 3, academia. And beauty about being at Oxford, I'm talking to people in this room who are at Oxford. So I've got a message for you. Academics will no doubt at some stage be entrusted with the powers to investigate what happened, make recommendations, and assist in improving public and social policy. However, it is incumbent on research centres to call upon the services of community people as active participants in processes that will enable them to be stakeholders in any research inquiries that's undertaken. Furthermore, I'm advocating that community people should seek to enlist the support of academics in enabling community members to name their own reality and become the authors of their own lives as also a way of healing and restoration. Which means that they're going to come knocking on your door. Community businesses. Raising the profile and development of community businesses within communities is vital to increase the visibility of those services in the wider social economy and social structure. The disconnect between community-based service providers can at times be blighted by numerous factors where those concerns are rendered invisible in the wider social economy. Therefore, there is a need to ensure that responses to community need are placed within a business framework to create the possibility for self-determined actions, as well as reducing the systemic dependency that occurs all too often. The government's expenses scandal, the news of the world, phone hacking, the banking crisis, created a moment where young people on the streets saw this as street-level white-collar crime. They have watched middle-class white people bankrupt this country here in Europe and said, JD Sports, Orange, we're going to take them out because it's white collar crime. And they did it on YouTube, MySpace, and they organized themselves. So in conclusion, which is 10 lines because I've got to finish. In conclusion, any future work undertaken in the name of young black people must provide opportunities not just for self-reflection, but scope for creating a new future. Operating through a lens that at times is colourblind, that continues to perpetuate black invisibility at many layers of the social structure and maintains a position of white privilege, needs to be both contested and challenged. This new future will require all community members, victims, perpetrators, young and old, black and white, to create a new template from which to begin the restoration of a generation who feels subordinated, oppressed, excluded, and more importantly, placing a massive strain on intergenerational relations within the black community. So thank you, and that's it.